From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, after thousands of kids walked out of school yesterday to protest the lack of gun control laws, the survivor of a school shooting shares her perspective on the current debate.
You know, it's hard to say why this and not previous horrific events, but I think each one actually does bring more and more people to the table, and maybe this is the one that's going to finally affect change.
Later, poet, rapper, and activist Theo Wilson talks about the lessons he gained by impersonating a white supremacist troll online.
And we meet English soprano Kate Royal before her performances for the Florentine Opera this weekend.
What I love and what I always try to do is just to have no barriers, you know, so to be open and to be vulnerable, I think, is sort of what I try to do in order to allow the audience in.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Around the country, including here in Wisconsin, yesterday, thousands of students walked out of school to demand action on gun control. The organized walkout comes after the latest high-profile school shooting, which resulted in 17 deaths at a high school in Parkland, Florida.
We've spoken with Devorah Heitner on this show before about her work with kids and tech. But Heitner herself is a survivor of a school shooting, and she recently wrote about her experience for Time magazine. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
What have you observed so far as you've been watching really what's been going on at your kids' school, at other schools in the Chicago area especially?
Well, a lot of the elementary schools here in Evanston, Illinois, I believe all of them, the kids did a 17-minute observance. They were outside, and at my son's school, they did a peace circle, which I thought was a very appropriate way to deal with the range of information that kids in a K-5 school would have about the reasons that for the school walkout, which is that, you know, where people are trying to think about policies to make school shootings and mass shootings less likely. But, you know, for a kindergartner or a first grader who maybe has been shielded from at least some of the news about gun violence, a peace circle, I think, is a very appropriate way for an elementary school to observe that this is happening, give students a chance to participate, give older students a chance to speak out. So some of the signs that older kids were carrying in our community did refer to gun violence, to protecting kids more than guns, other statements like that, yet still gave younger kids a chance to be responsive at a developmentally appropriate level. So I thought that was really nice. In the middle schools and high schools here, kids did do a 17-minute walkout with the support of school administrations. And the high school students were actually calling their reps on issues related to gun control. And we, unfortunately, our governor yesterday vetoed one of the gun control measures that was up for consideration in Illinois. So they were calling him, they were calling other people. So they really took that time to do direct political action. And then they went back to class. So I heard from teachers at the school that it was a very successful action, and that any disparaging comments about, oh, kids just want to miss school, were completely misplaced, that the students really used the time in a very focused way and then, you know, returned to school to continue their day.
This is an issue that is very near to you as a survivor of a school shooting. Can you talk a little bit about what your experience was like? It happened at a time that I think now, especially with the current dialogue, we don't tend to think about having a lot of school shootings before
Absolutely.
The 2000s.
Absolutely. So we're in a really different moment then. So I survived a school shooting in 1992. I was a student at Simon's Rock College, which was a college for kids who wanted to leave high school early for whatever reason, whether some of my classmates were kids from small towns who had run out of classes to take at small high schools, and others of us had various social and emotional issues in high school, or we were just bored. But it was a school full of kids who all identified as being a little different, I would say. So when this happened, we felt like Simon's Rock was a refuge. It was a place where we had found a community of people like us. Many of us were academically challenged for the first time. We were super excited to be there. It was also a little bit of an isolated place, so it felt a little bit like a haven. I was coming from a more urban community, and so living in Western Massachusetts felt very safe, very idyllic. And all of a sudden, a student that I didn't know very well, I'm not sure I would have even recognized him on site, even in our small campus. He had been apparently planning this for some time. And when he turned 18, he went and bought a semi-automatic weapon at a local sporting goods store, smuggled it onto campus that evening in a guitar case, and very methodically, you know, planned to kill everyone on campus. And he had ordered his bullets through the mail, and they'd been apprehended. And this is so horrible to remember, because this is how this all could have been prevented. An administrator had reported that the student had received bullets in the mail, and they still gave them to him because he apparently told an administrator he was taking them home to go hunting over winter break with his family. He was able to buy the gun because he was 18, that even though in Massachusetts he wouldn't have been able to purchase a gun, his home state was Montana. And at that time, there was a loophole in the laws in Massachusetts that your ability to purchase a gun was determined by your eligibility in your home state. The student had a gun. He started a shooting rampage on campus, and he murdered a professor in his car, Nakanyan Saez, and he murdered a student, Galen Gibson, and shot several other students and also a security guard who was actually, I think, the first person that he wounded, and grievously. She's 25 years later still dealing with very serious injuries from that night, and was pretty clearly was planning on killing everyone else as well. But his gun jammed, and then he ended up turning himself in, potentially in frustration. We don't really know, but he stopped the rampage because of this technical problem with the gun, which is why the rest of us are here to tell the story. And it was such a bizarre experience. I was studying with my friends in one of my friends' bedrooms. This was finals week. It was December, the very end of the semester. And we were hanging out in his room, all writing papers and finishing work. And we got a call to get away from the windows and lock the door on the on-campus apartment, and that someone had a gun and was going around killing everyone. And there was a moment where we all thought it was a joke, but it was very clear that it was serious. And we heard sounds, including gunshots, that made us realize how serious it was. And then much, much later, we heard police. And what seemed like hours and hours later, but was, I think, about an hour later, we got a call saying that it was safe and that the student had been taken into custody. And I later learned the police were afraid to come onto campus because they didn't know how many assailants there were, and they weren't heavily armed. I mean, it was just such an insane situation. And we sat there in my friend Stefan's bedroom, you know, thinking that we were all going to die. It was very bizarre. I remember feeling really angry. I remember feeling really distressed that I hadn't accomplished very much yet in my life because I was 17. So I definitely was feeling very much like there was nothing I could do. There was no sense of, oh, well, I'm sure everything's going to be okay. I think we all felt fairly grim. And afterwards, there was a lot of numbness. And then when we found out that we had lost Nakanyan Saez and Galen Gibson, we were all devastated. Many of my friends were close with Professor Saez. I was close with Galen Gibson. He was someone who was friends with almost everyone. And I think a lot of people who were at Simon's Rock at that time, or certainly who knew Galen from his hometown in Gloucester, Mass, felt that way. He was a really beloved, wonderful person. And we were also stunned also that a fellow student would do this. It just seemed very unreal. And people who knew the murderer later said that they were less surprised that he had spoken about violence. But for me, who had no exposure to this other kid, it was just stunning that someone would do this. And I remember feeling very angry and thinking, if you hate the world that much, you know, you can end your own life, right? And not that I think suicide is no big deal, but it seems so much more ethical. I thought, well, if you hate the world, but why take other people with you? Why, you know, why kill people who do want to live and do want to be in the world? That was my 17-year-old response. But later, when I learned how easy it had been for the killer to get a gun, I was really enraged. And I hadn't thought that much about gun control, you know, before this happened in 1992. people who had guns seemed like a whole other world away from me. I didn't grow up in a hunting culture or in a street violence culture. I wasn't really around guns at all, except maybe at summer camp where we had, I think, riflery practice. And so it just seemed very bizarre to me that anyone would want a gun, or that it would be okay for an angry 18-year-old to just wake up one morning and go and buy one in a sporting goods store. That just seemed completely bizarre.
You know, this was the early 90s. What has it been like since then? Because there have been so many school shootings since that moment. When you see the news reels, when you see the new update about yet another school shooting, what goes through your mind?
Well, I'm very aware. I was also a professor for many years, and I'm very aware of the tensions on college campuses. I'm friends with some people who teach at Virginia Tech. So certainly when that happened, I was very aware of how unsafe all of us can be, you know, in a campus environment where people are just there to learn and to teach and to do their work, and no one's expecting someone to do this. And also the limits of, even if you know, in the Virginia Tech case in some ways was very similar, where it was a student who was at the school who was very angry, who had expressed an interest in violence in his writing. People knew that there were issues with this young man, but it wasn't really clear, you know, how to respond, how to keep the community safe. And we also know that sometimes people express really troubling ideas and don't commit violence. So it's really tricky. I mean, as a professor, as someone who's taught students who sometimes can be going through a hard time emotionally, it's really hard to know, at what point do I not feel safe meeting with a student for office hours? At what point do I feel like I need to call in for backup? At what point do I say that the student is, you know, shouldn't be on campus, right? These are very difficult questions. And so I think Virginia Tech really hit home for me. And then hearing about the survivors at Umpqua Community College, certainly when Columbine happened, I was still a relatively young person. I mean, all of these affected me, but I think it was after I became a parent, and then the murders in Newtown at Sandy Hook School, I think at that point I was, you know, just on the floor, like really, truly so devastated and distressed that this was still happening. Sandy Hook happened on the 20-year anniversary of the Simon's Rock shootings. And, you know, Galen Gibson's father, Gregory Gibson, who has written a lot about this and been an incredible activist for gun control, wrote that he and his wife were on their way to visit Galen's grave when they heard about Newtown, which is not so far from them because they're also in New England. And he felt this sense of, you know, complete frustration, like, how is this still happening? And I share that sense of just bewilderment that we are allowing anyone essentially who wants a gun, no matter how little reason they have, no matter how unstable they are, no matter what their proximity is to innocent people whose lives should also matter, right? They can get a gun. And this, so I think as a parent, Sandy Hook really petrified me. And my son was at a pre-K to 8 school, and they were going to do a response to Newtown and send cards and blankets to the children and the families who survived. And I was going to keep my kid home from school because he was 3 years old. And I just thought, how could we possibly talk to a 3 or 4-year-old about this? There's no way I want my little child to know that a bad person came into an elementary school and murdered children. And so I just felt like there's no way to message this that was appropriate at all. I couldn't think of one. So I was going to keep him home, but I did find out that the preschool classes weren't going to engage with this assembly, you know, which was beautiful. And I thought, of course, older kids who knew about this, who were feeling helpless, should find positive ways to reach out. But honestly, it's pretty hard to find a positive message in a situation like what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, or Parkland, Florida, or at Simon's Rock, or Columbine, right? And so, I mean, I think we struggle. Of course, we want kids to have hope, but it's hard to feel hopeful about this. I think the biggest hope for me is that we make it impossible for people to get these weapons.
You wrote a piece for Time where you talked about this cultural conversation that we're having right now. What do you think makes this moment different from what happened after Newtown, from what happened after Columbine?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, parents from Newtown did rise up and go to Washington. And if you look at their record, there's Moms Demand Gun Sense and all of these other groups have been very active. So I don't think anything that about what's going on now should lead people who've been fighting this fight for 20 years or 10 years or 5 years to feel like they haven't been doing their work, because I think a lot of us have been active, you know, working on gun control. But I think these students, just somehow the fact that they are standing up, and also some of the parents from Parkland, the fact that they're standing up to demand change so quickly after what happened, while the news cameras are still rolling, while they are still in the spotlight, I think the fact that these young people are so privileged, and so many privileged parents and educators around the country can see their own children reflected in these kids, which may be a little bit different than the young people of Ferguson and other young people who have also been speaking out about the violence that their communities experience. I think these kids also just were really skilled at social media, kind of like right message, right time. It's really hard to say what creates a tipping point for people. I thought Las Vegas, the mass shooting in Las Vegas, which, you know, was so horrific and so terrifying and so completely inexplicable in so many ways, would be a tipping point for people. But, you know, maybe this is the straw. I certainly think that these young people are commendable, and they've really taken this incredibly traumatic moment in their own lives, something that no child should have to live through. You know, it's hard to say why this and not previous horrific events, but I think each one actually does bring more and more people to the table, and maybe this is the one that's going to finally affect change. And we're seeing, you know, if some legal changes already, but also these retailers making some changes, which of course is tremendously important as well.
Yeah. Well, Devorah, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. And thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Devorah Heitner is an expert on kids and digital technology. She's also the survivor of a school shooting that took place while she was in college. She spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find a link to her recent essay for Time magazine at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we meet poet and activist Theo Wilson, who shares what he learned by going undercover and impersonating a white supremacist online. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Theo Wilson wants us to have hard conversations about race, and he wants us to do it in person. Wilson might seem like an unlikely person to deliver that message as a poet and one who captured the title at the Erotic Poetry Slam in 2007, but the African-American poet and rapper is perhaps more famous for his stint as Lucius 25, a white supremacist online troll. The experience opened his eyes to the humanity of people whose views he profoundly disagrees with.
His TEDx talk about the experience and the lessons he draws from it have had 1.6 million views online so far, and it's what brought him to Carroll University this week. He also stopped by our studio as well. Theo Wilson, it is such a pleasure and an honor to meet you. Thanks so much for coming over this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I loved your TED talk, and I wanted to start with the idea of conversation and how conversation for you is the key to making things better. It sometimes seems to me that conversation is what gets us in trouble.
Yeah, listen, I want to be clear on something about conversation. There are multiple levels to the beast that we deal with when it comes to racism. However, conversation can attack one of them very well, and that's interpersonal racism. Not so much institutionalized, but interpersonal. What you have is the ability to humanize yourself and make it clear and abundantly, at least a visual, that you are somebody who has the same concerns as somebody across the aisle from you. and that if you do it right, you find out that there's a lot more in common than there are that separate folks. And so I think that's what I meant by conversations being the key to at least building bridges.
So the idea that sitting down with somebody that you just you fundamentally disagree with in a lot of cases, how do you get past the things that you disagree with that person?
Well, you know, one of the things that I said in the TED Talk is we're talking about face-to-face conversations as opposed to online conversations. And that is because the cage effect, you can see this in road rage, anger management, right? When you're in what you feel is a contained environment, certain parts of the aggressive side of your personality become amplified. Well, the same thing happens over the internet. But once you're face-to-face with somebody and you see, like, them living and breathing in front of you, you're, number one, faced with the immediate threat of the person right there. Is something that kind of puts some people who are of a hateful mindset on their heels. And they have to reckon with the fact that this is a person who is a human being versus the internet. Because there's no immediate consequence for you saying something hateful. There's no immediate threat if you should traverse somebody's personal boundaries. These are deep-seated, tribalistic, instinctual issues. And that if we have the courage to have these kind of conversations with folks in person, we may be able to get somewhere in terms of interpersonal racism and solving that problem.
I was going to say, what you're talking about sounds an awful lot like what people used to call civilization,
you know,
like putting aside that tribalistic, very me-centered way of being in the world and thinking about somebody else.
Absolutely. Well, the problem is that the way race is set up in the country is a zero-sum game. It's always, if this person gains, I have to lose, and vice versa. I understand the zero-sum game when it was originated. But right now, we literally have technologically out-evolved all zero-sum games. And it's funny because a lot of the technology came from war, came from setting up a victory for zero-sum games, meaning there's got to be positive sum here. There's got to be a way that we all can win. And the things that cause structural racism in this country— the things that have been studied in terms of housing discrimination and the economic consequences of that, they drag the nation down competitively against other Western nations who don't have these kind of issues. So if an African American is in poverty because of generational deprivation, that's still an American that's in poverty. And that counts when it comes to our rating against other countries and what they have in terms of their markers of civilization. So if we can actually get past this, everyone benefits. And it's time that we started to have that conversation so it can transverse into other areas.
When you went underground and became a sort of a white supremacist troll is pretty much what you did. Yeah. What surprised you the most about doing that? Because you basically walked the walk about what you're just saying about we have to have these conversations. You started by doing the trolling thing, but then kind of discovered some stuff about yourself.
Yeah, what I realized was that the folks who are in the alt-right generally are ultimately the victims of an educational system. And so I don't want to take them off the hook in terms of their own bigotry. Let's be clear on that. What I found was that this is the inevitable outcome of when you don't teach history the right way. There are things that you miss. And that when you have a set of rules like political correctness, a few generations down the line, the conditions that made the rules necessary begin to evaporate. So naturally, people begin to question the rules in and of themselves. What folks don't realize is that when you remove these barriers of saying words that harm people, when you remove the barriers that stop people from denigrating someone's humanity, the conditions that originated the rules arise again. And so when you attack that and you don't know the history behind that, that's something that is obviously destructive. And we have to figure out how to recontextualize our relationships in terms of the history that we're actually not that far removed from.
No, because we're not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure when you were born. I grew up in the 60s.
Born in the 80s, yeah.
Okay, I was born in the late 50s and grew up in the 60s and 70s. Civil rights movement, women's rights movement, those early days of those things, and seeing major changes happen, and then, of course, the backlash.
And the backlash. And that's kind of historically the cycle with America. The old folks say, and I don't want to be too crass here, but the old black folks say, the white man giveth and the white man taketh away. It's, you know, you can see the cycle happening after the Emancipation Proclamation. There was an era during the Reconstruction period up until 1877 where there were great advancements in black life, including the first black lieutenant governor ever elected in the state of Louisiana, Oscar Dunn. So that, I mean, you would never think that that would happen before 1900, and yet still it did. And then the betrayal of 1877 with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes brought in the Jim Crow era. People think Jim Crow started right after slavery. That's not true. There was this gap. And then so you have then the advancements made from the civil rights movement. And right after that, you have the expansion of the prison industrial complex, the new Jim Crow, the laws that criminalize basically survival behavior. So then that incarcerates so many African Americans, and we're still dealing with the fallout from that right now.
In this state, very, very much so.
I bet. I would love to hear more of that.
The highest rate of black male incarceration in the nation.
Wow.
In this state.
See what I'm saying? So, like, you know, and then you have, you know, in this era, following the first black president, you have this, what Van Jones called a white lash, those who felt oppressed somehow underneath Barack Obama. Now having, quote unquote, their say in the era that we see now. So, yeah, this is a cyclical thing. And once history is discovered like that, black folks have some interesting choices ahead of us in terms of how to deal with this cycle and getting out, because this cycle takes our lives, you know.
Well, what about white people like me?
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest that, particularly the people on the alt-right, who have absorbed these ideas that are not constructive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, conversations are wonderful, but what's the next step? How do you take it so that it becomes policy, it becomes civilization?
Well, I mean, you know, reality asserts itself. If you have an erroneous idea in your head about race and the value of human life, eventually, that will come to be corrected. What needs to be done, I think a lot of stuff is already becoming at least apparent in terms of action steps. The fact that, like, for example, after Charlottesville, there was great pressure in the country to classify white extremist groups as terrorists and to treat them as such. You know what I mean? That political will ain't going anywhere. That's on its way. What's being titled the blue wave this November's election season, if Alabama was any indicator on what the electorate is going to do, then, you know, we have a possible new wave of policymakers that will institute policy changes that will make certain punitive actions against those who are domestic terrorists, like folks who act in white supremacist ideology, make those measures stick. And so I think that's a good thing. But also in terms of the alt-right, I think a lot of them are starting to realize, you know, especially after Charlottesville, you guys are on the wrong end of history again. That's a tragedy. There's so much history to learn. This is the age of Google. You can find out anything you need to know. And if you don't take the steps to have some accountability in this, then you'll end up a hate criminal, and that will stick with you forever. You know what I mean?
But going back to what you've talked about a number of times about the echo chamber, you know, how do you get people out of their – whatever their echo chamber is, whether it's a very conservative one, a very liberal one where you think you're being open and progressive but you're not necessarily.
Yeah.
How do you get people outside of that echo chamber?
Well, the first step was to acknowledge that it exists. And I think one of the great things about my TED Talk is it seemed, and I don't know if I was in my own echo chamber with this, but it seemed like after the TED Talk hit, a lot more conversation around what echo chambers are and their consequences began to take place in the country. And once you realize that you're in a liberal echo chamber, then you have to figure out, okay, these folks who are conservatives are your neighbors. They're people that your children may date one day. You know what I mean? If you stop at condemnation, then what do you truly gain with that? You see what I'm saying? The issue is that the way the tribalization is with the country right now, I've seen the left be more honest and accountable with holding their standard bearers accountable than I've seen the right as of late. There's this fear, it seems, on the right to be intellectually honest about, like, the consequences of the Trump administration. Be honest about what it means that he can't keep any staff, including recently with the firing of Rex Tillerson. Like, what it means that there seems to be a blame game going on that wants to indict everybody but the person in charge and the people who put them there. And so that's going to have a cost. If you don't break out of your echo chamber, then the consequences when they hit will be that much more severe.
Severe for everyone.
For everyone.
Because we're talking about the structure of the country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, that's terrifying.
It is. And I have cousins, you know, who are black conservatives. You know what I mean? Like, black conservative people who are married also to white conservative people. And a lot of conservative people are concerned about the actions of our supposedly conservative president, who was a limousine liberal up until 5 years ago. And what we find is that he has gotten to the point where he's learned a dangerous trick that he can get to the top of the news cycle if he dismantles the country from within. And that is dangerous because we've got too many enemies out here who are looking for a weakened state. And regardless of where you fall in terms of the spectrum of patriotism, we're all connected to this thing. And so we as a nation have to figure out the political atmosphere that got us in this kind of danger and make sure that we never cross that threshold again and figure out ways to work together across partisan lines. And I hope that that's what my talk can at least inspire people to do.
Well, also the other thing you do is poetry slam. And poetry is another very immediate way to talk to people. And that's one of the reasons you're here in Wisconsin as well, is to you're holding a poetry slam, aren't you?
I'm teaching kind of a workshop on how I did what I did. So the thing that got me on the TED stage was that they invited me in to be kind of a palate cleanser of a poet. And my poems were just terribly popular at those TEDx Mile Highs. But spoken word, you know, I started off as a rapper anyway. So rap is just rhythmic, aggressive poetry. I began to take my raps to poetry competitions and win them. And over time, I evolved into an actual slam poet and won the National Poetry Slam about 6 or 7 years ago. And so that opened up gates. And so it's just kind of this thing, this evolution from rapper to poet to speaker and performer.
Do you think that poetry as an art form is a way that we can talk to each other and listen to each other?
Poetry's super immediate. Like, when if you got a poetry venue, you know, you can have, you know, 200 to 300 people there sometime every week, you know. And with that, you have the chance to literally, if it's an open mic, you can write something and get your message out to 200 to 300 people like that. You know what I mean? Those people are all voters. Those people all hold sway in certain industries sometimes. You never know who's in the audience. And so, yeah, I have seen poetry change public opinion. And I think that it's a very, very powerful means, especially when you got a sitting audience and a culture that's already open to it.
Yeah, I think art always, in its best sense, speaks truth to power.
It does.
Always.
Yeah, and historically speaking, it's been the poets that have been the canaries in the mineshaft when social change is about to happen. You know, out-and-out revolutions have been kind of captured by poets in their art, you know, since time immemorial. So, yeah, poetry is one of those things. It distills language, which distills thought, which distills a zeitgeist if you do it right.
Do you consider yourself a canary in the coal mine?
I don't think I couldn't be. There's no way that I wouldn't be in terms of what's happening in our culture right now. I'm very grateful to have been allowed access to certain platforms to share what I know, because I think that when change comes, there's always a warning. And if it's going to be a negative change, then there's a warning before destruction. And hopefully I can aid in that. You can only shine the light. If folks choose to turn away, that's on them. But I'm here to shine whatever light that I have.
Well, Theo Wilson, we are so happy you are here to shine that light.
Thank you so much for having me.
Theo Wilson is a poet, rapper, and social activist. He spoke about his experience impersonating an online white supremacist troll at an event at Carroll University this week. There is a link to his TEDx talk about it at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then meet English soprano Kate Royal, who's in town this week to perform for the Florentine Opera. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. This weekend at Eline Hall, the Florentine Opera deviates from its normal production schedule to offer an evening of some of opera's greatest hits. Various singers associated with the company will perform solos, duets, and ensembles.
But for opera lovers, perhaps the star attraction is English lyric soprano Kate Royal. She's performed around the world with opera companies, orchestras, and luminaries ranging from the Berlin Philharmonic to Paul McCartney. Viva Opera will be performed Friday and Sunday, and we had a chance to sit down ahead of the performances. Kate Royal, it is such an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It is such a treat to have you here to sing. And I wanted to talk about the kind of performance this is, because normally you are in a full opera. You're taking a part from beginning to end. This is pieces. This is almost like a recital.
Yes,
version.
This Viva Opera concert. It's kind of an opera gala. So it's greatest hits. And some perhaps not so obvious pieces, a really lovely mixture. But it is a challenge to do these kinds of things because you are on and off stage all the time. So it's very hard to sort of get into a flow, and you sort of come on, do your piece, and then go off. And so it's hard to get into any kind of character. So you have to find the balance, you know, between telling the story, even though in an aria it's probably two or three lines repeated. So it is quite hard to find a connection with the audience, I think, in this kind of thing.
I was wondering about that, because in an opera you have a chance to develop that character, but in this kind of performance you have to, like, come on and just do the set piece.
Yeah.
And go off. Musically, not even character-wise, but musically, what kind of challenge does that present for you?
The challenge lies actually in the order of the things you're singing. And luckily, they've programmed it in a way, anyway, selfishly for me, where it works sort of vocally. So I'm starting, I think, with a duet, which is quite relaxed and it's not too stressful. So it's a kind of a nice ease in. But yeah, it's wonderful from the audience's point of view, because they don't, you know, it's all the really fun bits and all the loud bits and the high bits and the funny bits. But for us poor souls that have to go and do it, it's tricky. It is.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. But like you say, it is one of those things that the audience gets to react to in a way. And I know you have talked before. I was reading a Guardian interview that you did a few years ago where the interviewer asked you about what you would like to see changed about how audiences and classical musicians and singers interact with each other. And I think having that kind of talking and being sort of part of it, this kind of performance would help.
I think it's really difficult to let the audience in. Opera is a very opera singing is quite a it's such a personal thing, and every singer and every character on stage is so different, and we all treat the audiences in a different way. I mean, what I love and what I always try to do is just to have no barriers, you know, so to be open and to be vulnerable, I think, is sort of what I try to do in order to allow the audience in. I don't want to go and sort of throw something at them. I would rather they just come in and enjoy it with me. It's very hard to put into words, especially when you're in a big theater. It's very, very difficult. And often, you know, as the singers, you can't see the audience. You know, I love doing recitals where it's small scale and it becomes an ensemble with the audience. But I think to try and break down these barriers of, well, I'm the opera singer and I'm here in this pretty dress and I'm singing at you, to try and shake it off, as Taylor Swift would say, and especially for people that are new to opera and classical music in general, it's a terrifying thing because it's the unknown. It's usually a language that you don't speak. It's music you've never heard. Some of it's challenging. Some of it you might not like. And so, you know, a lot is expected of an audience, especially if they're coming and they're new to it. I would say don't expect to love everything. And the great thing about this kind of concert is there's so much variety. And so they can come away going, do you know what? I really don't think I like French music. I much prefer Italian, or, you know, and that's the great thing about it. But yeah, just to break down the barriers, really.
Yeah, it's funny. We have, in the probably the last 150 years or so, this idea that the audience sits quietly and you come in and you have this role to play as the audience and you don't interact. And my understanding of music history is that that wasn't always the case. Mm-hmm. In Mozart's day, people were very enthusiastically responding in the moment, kind of like Shakespeare, where, you know, almost throwing things if they didn't like it.
Yeah, absolutely. When in some places in Europe and Italy, for sure, they're still screaming and shouting and booing and all sorts. I'm not encouraging anyone to boo. I don't want to hear any booing. But the audience does have a role to play. You know, as a performer, if there's somebody that's kind of checking their phone whilst you're singing and you see it, because you do see it, even if they're miles away, you can sense it. It completely distracts you. It distracts everybody else. It's not a cinema. It's not a movie theatre, because we are real people and we really kind of need the energy from the audience, you know. And I think it's really hard for audiences to understand that as well. It's a communal thing. It's all of us together, you know, and all of us together can make something happen. But without the audience being tuned into what we're doing, then we can't create anything.
Right. You know, if we're not engaged, then there's that missing piece. Yeah.
Obviously, it's our job to engage you in the first place. So I'm not kind of putting any blame on audience members. It's just, I think people that maybe don't go to the theatre very often, or live theatre, it's, you know, it's becoming more and more rare. And we're so used to watching something for 5 minutes and then going and doing something else. And then it takes concentration to sit for 2 hours and to focus on that thing.
You think classical music is getting better at engaging audiences where they are and making them feel a part of it, as opposed to a passive receptor?
Yes and no. I think certainly in terms of young people, I think a lot of work is now being done to open up what we do and make them understand what we do and to bring them into productions and to kind of show them the fun side of it, and to, as we said before, just to break down that kind of stiff barrier, the thing that scares people. Well, what is opera? You know,
people singing loudly.
It's this thing of people sing loudly and it's elitist and it's expensive and it makes people panic. Just the thought of it makes a lot of people panic, my friends included. I mean, I can't persuade them to hardly come to anything I do. So if I, you know, it's very, very difficult for people that have that that sort of gut reaction to it. The other issue I have, and I don't know how it is so much here, but in Europe, there's a lot of really wacky, bizarre staging of opera. And some of it is very, very interesting and some of it works. But we have to understand that the people coming to see us may never have heard that opera before. But we are presuming that they know already the plot. We're presuming they've seen that famous production in, you know, 18 blah, blah, blah. We're presuming that they know all this information. And we're adding layers and layers onto that that we go through during the rehearsal period. And they are no part of it. And we're expecting them to kind of understand that journey. And I think that that doesn't go down so well with me. I think that directors need to talk to their audiences. They need to explain to their audiences why we're all dressed as fish, or why we are, you know, digging graves or whatever it might be, and take them on that journey.
Is there anything that you think that the classical music and the opera world can learn from the pop world in terms of how they tell their stories? I know they're dealing with different kinds of effects and they're mic'd and all of those things. But do you think that there's some sort of immediacy that can be taken from that world and translated into opera?
That's a really interesting question. I think that the pop world is is led by sales, you know, and I am led by words and poetry. It sounds incredibly naff now I've just said that. But, you know, what makes me want to do what I do is I see some words on a page, I know they've been set to music, and I figure out how I'm going to interpret those words through music, through my voice. And not all the time, but a lot of pop singers, mainly the most popular ones, if you actually wrote down the lyrics of what they're singing, I mean, honestly, it is bad and it's dreadful. And they could have written that in 20 seconds. There are also some wonderful artists who treat it as poetry and have some wonderful lyrics. But the two are just such completely different things. I think the social media aspect of the pop world, obviously that makes them closer to their audiences because they are constantly communicating with them about every detail of their lives. So I guess their audiences feel they know them better, perhaps. Does that happen in the opera world with opera singers? I don't know. I'm not online in any way, shape or form. So I don't know if singers now are creating these sort of profiles where they're chatting with their audiences. Probably they are.
The music and the stories, the poetry is so beautiful and so worth sharing and so worth having out in the world. I'm always trying to think of ways of how can we break down those barriers and make people feel welcome into this world, like mm-hmm. you say, that they don't necessarily know.
I mean, I think it's one of those things that if you try and force it on people, I think they will run a mile. It takes effort for an audience member or for someone to engage themselves in this thing we call opera. It's not quick necessarily. It's something over time that builds and can become a wonderful hobby and a wonderful passion. I'm talking as a listener of classical music. But, you know, if you force it onto people, then it has to come from them. You know, it has to come from them. And also, we don't have much of an attention span these days. And that doesn't really go in our favour. Because, you know, if we want someone to sit and listen to a symphony for an hour and a half, it's tricky. Yeah. It is tricky, no question. But by putting in the work and putting in the effort, you get so much out of it. But it's difficult to explain that to somebody that hasn't done it. Because, you know, it takes you on a journey. And it can be so unbelievably fulfilling. And then once you've listened to something once, and then if you can bear to put yourself through it again, then suddenly you start to understand. If you are not a musician and you've got all this noise coming at you, you'll go, oh, yes, I remember that little bit, that little na 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 na, or that little tune that was in the I remember that. And then the next time you'll hear it again, oh, yes, that's the horn. Ah, and then if you go and see it live, then again, another layer is added. And then you can buy another recording and go, oh, well, it really sounds, it's the same music, but they sound so different in a way. And that's because of the tempo and that's, you know, the way the conductor wanted to do it. There's so much that you can discover on your own without even needing to go to a concert. But the experience of an acoustic environment is something that everybody should experience. We're so used to everything being loud because we can just turn the volume up. You go to a concert and you understand that it's a different kind of mindset. It's a different kind of soundscape. And it takes some getting used to because you think everything's going to be really loud. But then, of course, you're in a massive theatre and you've got the orchestra playing. And it's all relative, and you have to tune yourself into it. So there's lots of different aspects to it, but it's a slow burn. And this kind of gala is a perfect way to dip your toe in and hear some of the best bits, and then you can attach those best bits to the operas and then go and discover those operas and go and listen to them, or you can watch some scenes from them on YouTube or whatever and then start to build it from there.
Yeah, YouTube is wonderful. That's where technology comes in because you can go and say, oh, I heard this singer. Mm-hmm. What else has she done? Mm-hmm. You know, and I might not get to see you in London or I might not get to see mm-hmm. you in Berlin, but I can go to YouTube yep. and hear an aria that you did. Mm-hmm. And I think that technology is helping in that way. I hope it is. I hope it gets people you go down the YouTube rabbit hole. And, you know, one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you find yourself somewhere you had no idea you were going. And you went, I just discovered a singer I never even knew or a piece of music I never heard.
And you can then listen to so many versions of the same thing. And then you can start to build an opinion about what you think and how something should be done. And, it's endless. And it's slightly terrifying. I've found myself doing that as well, you know, just and 2 hours have gone by. Okay, that's enough.
You've got to stop now. When you have a moment, what do you listen to? Does it just depend on mood?
I love silence. And that's really not a good way to be selling classical music. I love silence because my life is filled with noise, whether that's noise coming from me or from my colleagues or my children. I love silence. And to me, silence is one of the most beautiful things ever. And it's rare, you know, it's rare.
And it's crucial in music.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. You know, and that's another wonderful thing that you do sometimes get in a concert. Not so much in an opera, but in a concert hall within, a symphony. This collective silence, this hundreds or thousands of people sitting in one room, but it's completely silent. And that's a phenomenon. I mean, I just absolutely, again, that's something that everyone should experience. You know, I've sat in the middle of the Berlin Philharmonic stage taking part in Mahler's Second Symphony. Now, that experience of sitting there with the orchestra around me, if anyone gets the chance to get close to the orchestra and get close to the sound, it takes you somewhere else. It really does. So, yeah, all these experiences are out there. But you're not going to get them if you don't just go and buy a ticket and go and see something. But this, the live experience, there is nothing that YouTube can do for you on that level. The live experience, the energy, you don't get that from watching a screen. You know, the energy that the audience give to us, that we give to the audience, that the audience give to each other. That's why I do it. That's what makes me excited.
Well, Kate Royal, it has been such an honor to have you in the studio to talk about music and about silence, which are two sides of the same coin,
absolutely.
I think. And best of luck this weekend. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
English lyric soprano Kate Royal appears Friday and Sunday at Florentine Opera's Viva Opera Gala Performance at Eline Hall. There is more information at WUWM.com. And Kate Royal closes out today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.